My name is Karen Blomquist, and this is in the last of a series of sessions we've been having this week dealing with the ELCA sexuality study, which I remind you is available in the bookstore. It's a good, cheap price. If you haven't seen it in your congregation, or if you're not ELCA or whatever, I encourage you to purchase copies before you go home. Tonight's title is, we're going to spend a little time with that, and namely, the title is The Quality of Our Sexual Relationships. But I also want to allow some time for just some open-ended questions and dialogues and for you to press some questions that we haven't had time to deal with. I'm aware that we've really done some focusing on some questions, and there's a whole host of other issues and questions related to sexuality that we haven't tried to focus in on this week simply because we could only touch down on a few things. But tonight's discussion is going to occur particularly with some small group discussion. I think it might be helpful for us to get at some of the most helpful comments along that line. But before we do that, let me just say something about the topic. First of all, I recognize that the title itself can be somewhat misleading, especially in light of all of the obsession with quality, quality this, quality that, that goes on in our society. And it might strike some of you as saying, well, here we go with another one of these talk show kinds of questions of, well, tell us how your sex life is, or quality in terms of, well, the more the better, or, well, if it's not fulfilling, then get out of your present relationship and find a new partner. So let me begin by acknowledging that that very word quality has some real problems with it, particularly within American culture and the kind of search for, you know, more and better and all those kinds of words that we think of when the word quality comes up. I think there's a real problem also in that if we get into a thing of trying to raise up all these ideal qualities of what a sexual relationship should be like, most of us realize that, hey, whatever sexual relationship we may or may not be involved in probably doesn't measure up. And therefore, there can be all kinds of, well, you know, embarrassment, guilt, maybe I'm crazy to stay in the relationship that I'm in. So I think we need to at least acknowledge some of those factors up front before we begin. In the work that the task force that has worked on this study has done thus far, one of the things that occurred to us early in our discussion is that for the most part, what official positions on the church in the past have tended to focus on, or at least what a lot of people are interested in, is finding, well, what are the bounds or what are the structures and what is appropriate within what structures. And certainly, as we're well aware, marriage being seen as the structure within which sexual intercourse is an appropriate expression. And I think in our day, part of the difficulty with thinking only in terms of the structure is that some of the factors related to the quality of relationship that can or that does or does not flourish within that structure, some of those factors, some of that discussion never actually takes place. So for example, many on the task force are well aware of the fact that simply to say, well, if it occurs within marriage, then it's somehow okay, then it's somehow ethically appropriate. And then we never really get into the discussion of really saying, okay, what are some important qualities of that expression of who we are that occurs through sexuality and through sexual relationships of one kind or another? Let me just share with you two brief passages in the study. If some of you have it along with you, it's page 40, and then I'll be reading on page 36 and 37 after that. One of the subgroups of the task force that spent a lot of time talking about and looking at issues of sexual abuse said, okay, if there's all these incidents of sexual abuse around us, how can we as the church be much more intentional in talking about
what are characteristics of healthy sexual relationships? And these are some of the things that they came up with, and I want you to at least think of these. We're going to be doing some discussing in small groups, so you might want to kind of keep track of some of the things you hear in this that you like or don't like. What are characteristics of healthy sexual relationships? They are safe places, safe spaces, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. This is basic. Violence, coercion, and threat are not acceptable. People are safe to talk about their real feelings and fears. They are able to share their imperfections and strengths with each other. People are able to reveal who they really are, to take risks, because of their enduring commitment to one another. The partners listen deeply to each other. Secondly, they are relationships in which emotional and physical intimacy is expressed. Partners are able to be vulnerable, to receive from and give to each other. Personal sharing deepens and sustains physical intimacy. Touching and embracing are sometimes a matter of sexual delight, and at other times express closeness, protection, acceptance. Third, trust and honesty are nurtured. Trust can be broken or deepened. Learning effective but tactful ways of sharing honest observations and feelings with a partner is important. Fourth, there is respect for both the body and the spirit of one another. Differences are respected. They are not seen as threats. The integrity and well-being of both persons are appreciated and cherished. Fifth, power is not hierarchical or controlling, but mutual. We've been talking a lot the last 2-3 days about the importance of mutual respect, self-giving, loving relationships. There is fairness, reciprocity, equal sharing. Power is not based on one winning and the other losing. Partners do not seek to control each other, but to empower each other. They can negotiate about their differences. Six, the relationships are never static. They are always changing through both brokenness and growth. A healthy relationship involves work and play, repentance and renewal, movement and change. Seven, in healthy relationships, the partners are not boxed into stereotyped gender roles. They are free to reject qualities or activities that are supposed to be for their gender, or to affirm them if they fit. Eight, healthy relationships are made possible through God's grace. In these relationships, persons know they are loved by God and by others. They can love themselves and accept and love the other. The love of the cherished partner makes possible a deepening self-acceptance. Joy and laughter, humor, playfulness are especially central to healthy relationships. Our human vulnerability and frailties, most evident in our sexual lives, remind us not to take ourselves too seriously. And finally, the partners are not turned in upon themselves or their relationship, but are freed through Christ to give themselves away in service or mission for the sake of others. I'm going to go on and briefly read a passage on page 36 and 37 that talks about commitment. The erotic connection between two people expresses and establishes a deep bond between them. Various feelings come together: bodily excitement, a sense of being at home with this special person, a desire to share life as the future unfolds. This bond is best respected and cherished when the partners have made promises to each other that express the meaning and mutual fidelity of this relationship. Such a promise is not generalized or abstract. It is made to a specific person who is part of a wider community. The commitment is not once and for all, but it is a process of deepening intimacy over time. People making commitments to each other need to be mature enough to understand and take seriously what they are promising. The commitment involves risk, including the risk that sometimes committed relationships fail. It also involves the work if the relationship is to remain healthy and growing. Often a marriage relationship can be deepened and enriched with the help of professional counselors or through marriage enrichment programs. The central biblical directive for all our relationships, to do what is loving and just for one another, becomes especially central in our sexual loving. We need to take seriously all the givens, both personal and communal, that constitute who that person is and what he or she will become. So that includes their gender and how they live out being male or female, their sexual orientation, their physical and emotional strengths and weaknesses, various social, psychological, political, economic, and spiritual realities, his or her cultural or ethnic background, and some of the related customs and taboos, the family dynamics within which he or she was raised, their own sexual history, and their other relationships and commitments to vocation, family, friends, and the wider world. In other words, we're talking about a commitment made within a much wider community, a commitment that is certainly far more than just a commitment between the two individuals. In other words, in our commitment to love one another, we begin with and continually encounter certain factors that are a part of who that other is, and we can't set those aside. The multifaceted reality of who that person is provides a kind of otherness that can't be ignored. We can't be guided only by our feelings, but we discover how different the other person is from us, no matter how much we might seem to be alike on the surface. This confounds our tendencies to define or control the relationship on our own terms. And so the reality of who each of us is gives shape and substance to this commitment within which we live out our vocation as sexual beings. When we become one flesh with another, a new we is created. Together we are called to a mission not just for our own sake, but for the sake of others. And such commitments make a difference in God's world. So, those are some thoughts from the sexuality study. I'd like you now to form groups of three or four people. I'd suggest no more than four. If you're here with your partner, I think it might be helpful if you turn the other direction and talk to somebody else. That may not always be possible to split up all the couples in this room, but let's spend the next 20 minutes maybe retrieving some of the things that you heard in the last 5 or 10 minutes and talk about that, but focusing on these questions. What are the qualities of a sexual relationship that you would recommend? One of the things we've discovered as a task force is there's an awful lot of wisdom of what makes for a healthy relationship within some of the members of our congregations who've been around for a while. We've had some experience of what does or does not make a marriage or a relationship of one kind or another work. And therefore, in a sense, this is saying, you know, hey, if you could recommend to younger people today What would you recommend? How is that nurtured? How can such commitments be sustained today? I'd like to see if in the next 15 or 20 minutes there's, say, two or three things that you can come up with in your group that are the kinds of things that you feel are particularly important in terms of those qualities or how they're nurtured or how the kind of commitment can be sustained. We're going to then do a little bit of talking about that. Okay? So turn your chairs around. Okay, let's hear what kinds of things the groups identified. I'm not going to go around in any systematic way, but would invite someone from each group to speak up and share some particularly helpful things that your group identified. Qualities, nurturing, et cetera.
A commitment, or like a life, go into a relationship that it's going to be a lifetime commitment.
Okay. In other words, not saying, well, maybe this will work out, and then I'll get out, but a real commitment for it to be lifelong.
We talked a lot about the importance of a Christ-centered in the relationship, and that seemed to be the foundation of a lot of what the task force came up with, but it was never mentioned.
Christ-centered. Want to say more about that? What are the qualities of a Christ-centered relationship?
Praying together, going to church together, the kids seeing that if you have kids, just the spouses seeing the commitment to Christ in each other.
Caring and loving relationship as you would see that Christ would want you to have.
Okay, caring and loving in that way?
Also forgiving and accepting forgiveness.
Okay. Caring, loving, forgiving. Part of the reason I'm pressing that is I'm well aware that there are some settings where in fact people would say, oh yes, we have a Christ-centered relationship, but doggone it, I'm going to beat her into submission. In other words, that can also become a veil for some fairly abusive relationships, which is why I wanted us to unpack a little bit more what qualities we were pointing to at that point. Okay,
we talked a lot about allowing each one to be an individual and then yet have the time for the togetherness. Not, you know, everything doesn't have to be, we've been married 44 years and we don't have to do everything together, and we need time to be alone and to do our own thing, and yet we need the time when we grow together by doing things together too.
Okay, and finding the right balance between.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, other things
under that would also include mutual respect. Mm-hmm. Being friends first.
Okay. So say some more about that.
Well, we were just discussing how, you know, get to know each other first before you commit to marriage.
Okay.
Get to know each other.
Not having common interest, which keeps the relationship going.
Right. So there's more than just some romantic attraction.
Mm-hmm.
There's something else. A lot more.
I think along being friends first, but that friendship has to stay as well as a love relationship. It has to be a friend relationship too, to nurture that part of the relationship, of being able to share with each other too.
Mm-hmm. Be able to to share your deepest feelings without being threatened.
That's a trust relationship too, isn't it? That we talked about there.
Okay. I think too that as we have been in the relationship longer, we have to be very careful to keep up the relationship between the two of us. Children come in, and children take a lot of time with the mother, and sometimes I've seen where when the children finally leave, as ours have left about 15 years ago, then there's really nothing left because the life has been so centered around the children. Somehow you've got to keep that relationship between the first deep relationship, so when the rest are gone, the two of you are left again, you have commonality.
Between the two, despite kids, let's put it that way. Some of us in this room know what that can be like.
I think it's also important to remember that marriage may not be involved in all these because the assumption of marriage and of kids may not happen with people who may be homosexual or may not want kids, etc. And we don't want to talk about any of that.
Okay. That certainly is I think an important question. Are we talking about qualities that can only be present between a man and a woman who are married to each other? I doubt if there's unanimity about that in this room, right? But let's just put it down here right now. Okay.
The other part of that question was only within marriage.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Other qualities. Did some of you find some particularly fresh or new ways of talking some of that? You know, certainly there are, I think I heard over here, well, yeah, we can kind of repeat all those nice words and, you know, nobody's going to take issue with those, but were some of you able to kind of find some fresh ways of talking about that can be helpful?
Sense of humor. That's sort of a good way to get to forgiveness somewhere along the line. If you can laugh at yourself and not take yourself too seriously.
Let's kind of stick that up here, okay?
One that we didn't talk about, but that occurred to me is just having fun in sex together.
Mm-hmm.
And one that we did talk about was being free to be who you are, not who your partner wants you to be.
Mm. Okay. That's kind of along this line, right? Any other things that you talked about?
We talk quite a bit about the nurturing part of it, because in the nurturing part of it, and you may get into this later, but you bring out the best in your partner, and just like with your kids, and play down the weaknesses and be to help the person develop the very best potential that they have. Also in continuing to have fun in the relationship and to bring freshness and vitality to that relationship. And that's part of the nurturing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe encouraging growth in each other too, that's part of nurturing, I guess, too. But there's some couples where one person doesn't like the other person to grow.
Mm-hmm.
More about that whole matter of nurturing the relationship or sustaining the commitment. I don't see those as separate. Those three questions are kind of flow together, so they were more to prime the pump rather than three separate kinds of answers. But other things that came out of your
I was just thinking of something we just did as grandparents. I went down and took care of 6 grandchildren so that the folks could go off for 2 weeks by themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've been thinking of when I say, despite the kids, you've got to keep up the relationship between the two of them.
But also expect change and to grow within that change, because nothing stays a constant for very long. You know, and if you're able to be flexible and change within that relationship, whatever it may be, I think the sustaining part just kind of takes care of it so well.
The flexibility.
Is that the key word there?
We also talked about, in terms of the nurturing question, having and using other friends.
Mm.
Having friends to help you solve your problems between you, having friends to meet some of your needs that your partner doesn't meet.
Mm-hmm. So again, countering that notion of it being just the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, in this sense, there needs to be an emphasis on there, but here it needs to certainly go beyond that, the wider community.
We talked about power when, and this is the opposite of what we want, but when one person has more power than the other, and I guess I see this in, I would say, a healthy decision-making process or communication where both people's needs are considered and they know how to compromise. And not one person wins all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Else, or does that pretty much exhaust it?
Maybe if I can piggyback on that last comment, it seems like in decision making, it's deciding what's really very important to you and letting your partner know that rather than having habits about decision making. I think it's just an elaboration of what you had said. And sometimes I think a couple gets into, at least in my experience, habits of decision making where it's just a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And when someone's told me it's very important to her to do something differently, then I listen perhaps
mm-hmm.
more often. Hopefully, I do.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself backing off from things when I think it really it doesn't make that much difference to me.
Hmm.
Really listening. I mean,
okay.
So often we're thinking our own agenda while the other person's talking, and we're not really hearing what they say.
Someone in our group mentioned knowing yourself.
Mm.
Someone who has an adult daughter and who said she would teach her, told her daughter to know herself before
mm-hmm.
committing to marriage.
Mm-hmm. That looks like a rather full platter.
I never would have gotten married if I thought I had the.
That's why I began this exercise. Let's be honest about the fact that, quote, if any of us measure up, any of us think we measure up, then, maybe we need to get a little concerned about people like that because clearly. One of the things the task force has talked a lot about is we never reach it, and therefore it's something that we aspire to. It's a kind of back and forward kind of movement, and at times there can be really bad years or really bad periods, but there's some important ingredients in here: the forgiving, the growth, the listening that enables things to go forward, as it were, after a period of what can be a rather dry, if not rocky, kind of period of time. Let's think about particularly this question that was raised from the balcony. When you look at the only within marriage question, certainly we began with the first response being that this necessarily is something that is lifelong. But let's think through, not should the church support marriage, I don't think that's up for grabs, but how could we as church people make a case or for why marriage, the lifelong commitment of marriage, is necessary for nurturing this. In part, what we're trying to do through the study is to get people to think about some of these factors that are part of our sexuality, not for the sake of saying, oh, well, somehow then all the church's teachings need to change, but as a friend of mine says, we've got to be much more serious about making a clear rationale for why that kind of commitment is important for nurturing these qualities, rather than just saying, well, you know, only within marriage, and let's not ever talk about the qualities of the relationship.
I'm not sure I can express this right, but I think our group's tried to hit on some of that a little bit when somebody brought up the analogy in the Bible that was made often about Christ and the bride and the groom and our relationship in there with the church and Christ being kind of wed together. That analogy seems to be pretty strong in the Bible. If it were that way, looking at the Bible, that would seem to be a pretty good case, I would think, to base a marriage on, or some of what we're talking about here. Does that make sense?
Okay.
I think that commitment in marriage is important to me, particularly because my wife is sitting next to me, and I want to say that right now. Certainly, this is not in our society is not universally accepted standard. And we just spent last week down in California with my niece, and she's lived with her boyfriend for 7 years. She believes very strongly that marriage destroys relationships. Mm-hmm. Sexual relationships and interpersonal relationships between people. And so she doesn't have any desire to get married at all. She's very happy living with her boyfriend, and they certainly have a wonderful relationship between them. But she feels strongly that marriage destroys that relationship when people begin to take one another for granted and all of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that standard, while it's very important to us in this room, obviously, is not universally accepted, nor has it been universally accepted in other cultures at other times.
That phrase you used, that marriage, from her perspective, marriage means, well, then you just take it for granted that the other person is going to be there. I mean, it seems as though that's one of the kinds of lines that one could look at it from the other way and saying it is only because we can depend on that person being there for us through thick and through thin, through, as someone was saying the other day, through the death and resurrection of our relationships, that can enable us to be vulnerable, to share fully, because otherwise, hey, if that person really knows who I am, well, they might just walk out the door next week. So the kind of taking for granted that person can be there, you know, I think that can be played both ways in terms of saying that's why we need marriage, you know, as well as saying, well, why get married?
I think it's also very important that we are clear when we're using the word marriage, what we mean by that. Is it a moment in time, or is it a process?
Yeah.
I mean, is it at the time that you have sexual intercourse? Is it the time when you say your vows in front of the pastor in the congregation? Is it the time when you make that personal commitment to the other person? Is it the time when you sign, the pastor signs his or her name on the dotted line of your marriage certificate? I think we have to be very clear when we're talking about the concept of marriage, what we mean by that.
Here's another part of that as well, and that is, what is marriage? Is it going to a chapel in Las Vegas? Is that the same thing which is legally binding as opposed to a marriage which in which two people share each other in terms of a commitment with a group of other folks that are the friends and Christ involved? So I think those are probably maybe more basic questions than just the word, because the word itself is merely a legal term that is relatively meaningless.
I'd like to go with what Ron was saying here for just a minute, and I sense in the way you asked that your position is that it's not just the moment when the pastor or actually the couple themselves make themselves husband and wife, but that it's an ongoing process.
I think it is, because if you look at many different cultures, that moment happens in many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have our certain way in our culture, but I think it's much more of a process. We're talking about a growing commitment to each other, and that's
I think becomes the point where we really do have to ask some questions. That does that therefore mean that kind of in-depth quality of a relationship and commitment is only present between those who have become, quote, legally married?
I wonder about your question, because you've talked about, you said, is it only within marriage? But is the
that kind of quality of relationship and commitment,
okay.
the kind of quality that the kinds of things we're talking about here?
Well, I would say that the vast majority of those characteristics are also the characteristics of true and intimate and committed friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And that those characteristics, I mean, my most sacred friendships hold all of those except, I think all of those except sexual intercourse. I mean, those characteristics are not just the characteristics of marriage, they're the characteristics of truly committed relationships. I don't know my point in that.
Yeah. It's an interesting book that Mary Hunt has written called Fierce Tenderness, which is a kind of feminist theology of friendship. Now, she tends to expand that notion far beyond the way a lot of people have, I think. But the way we typically say, well, there's friends and then there's lovers, and kind of never the twain shall meet kind of thing, in terms of as if it's two totally separate kinds of categories. What about more on this notion of, is marriage a process? And if so, what does that say about what has been the church's standard position of saying no sexual intercourse outside of marriage, outside of legal marriage? Or other things you want to talk about too, if you want to answer that one.
I'm not sure what you're asking. If you're saying, does the process differ from the church's definition of marriage?
Well, I was listening this afternoon to a tape that Elizabeth Bettenhausen did here earlier in the summer, and she was making reference to, for example, the LCA Sex, Marriage, and Family statement of 1970. And it's interesting that 22 years ago, that statement, when it was approved by the committee or whatever group worked on it, very much had this more process understanding of what that commitment of marriage is about. And when it got to the convention, there were lots of people were getting a bit nervous because, oh, you know, see the headlines. You know, the church is not saying firmly, you know, it's you know, marriage is the gateway. So it was amended at the convention, even though it's the place where it's amended, it makes it very clear that there was much more a process-oriented understanding of the growth of a relationship, where you can't necessarily say, well, when two people are ready to go to the altar, then it somehow has reached the point. You know, there may in fact be a number of places in the relationship where a commitment is made and is strengthened, and where even after the two people have officially had their marriage, the kind of ongoing commitment. I think that's why one of the practices of a reaffirmation of marriage vows that a lot of couples now do after, you know, 10, 25, 50 years of marriage, realizing that the relationship is quite different than the relationship that was celebrated through the first marriage. So we talk more about that kind of understanding. What does how does that change things? What do we do, for example, about 80-year-old people who have had a growing commitment to one another for a few years and yet realize that their pension or their social security will be lost if they legally become married? A number of people are raising that, maybe because of how many elderly people are in our churches and in many of those kinds of situations. Is there the possibility that the church might do some blessing of those unions or other unions for whom marriage is not legally possible, but who exhibit those qualities of commitment that we're talking about here?
You know, another question to me is the role of community in marriage. And I feel like in our culture we don't codify or we don't emphasize the role of community in marriage. And the more I live, the more I think that we should almost not talk about marriage outside of the context of community, because to me community, be it friends or be it faith community or whatever, are just essential to quality relationship. And I wonder if there are cultures in which marriage is seen as something in which a community makes a commitment to you and you make a commitment to a community. I was just involved in a wedding where a major part of the wedding was the vows of the community to the people,
mm-hmm.
to support the married couple,
mm-hmm.
to hold them accountable, to this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, yeah, that's interesting to me that we don't normally do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Along that side.
And it becomes very difficult to do it in our highly mobile society,
mm-hmm.
where a couple moves here and there and may have very little family that provides ongoing community. And the church, in fact, may be one of the few places where some of that community kind of stuff can be raised up.
Yeah, but living among both the African and the Chinese, we saw how much the relationship of the clan, the whole clan, had to do with this continuing relationship between two people.
Yeah.
And as you say, we don't have that.
Yeah. So the sustaining of marriage has a lot to do with the rebuilding of community in our society that goes far beyond just family and marriage, but
right.
a lot of the communal bonds that have broken down in our society. Our time is almost up, but a couple more comments.
But since your first day of presentation, I've kind of forgotten what you told us the purpose of the church in putting this together is.
Mm-hmm.
But from what we've done here tonight, it seems like what we're doing is getting together our ideas on what works and what makes for successful relationships, what can help people to get through life successfully in these areas, and I think that's a really healthy direction to take. People's personalities are different, and I don't think this should be a rule book.
No.
I think it should be a how-to book, a help book. And I don't know, just in this particular area, I see that's what it could be. Some of the other things we've touched on, it's probably more difficult for us to do that, but I think that would be a good direction
see, I
to
think
take.
I think it's this kind of guidance that we should be, we meaning the church as a whole, should be providing one another. I mean, to me, this is the really substantial stuff. Unfortunately, it's particular issues related to homosexuality or this or issue or that issue or whatever that we tend to get really hung up on and don't get to what are some of these important things that pervade all of our relationships. You know, how do we take seriously the need to rebuild some of that and find ways of effectively supporting and making it more than just lip service, I hope. You know, because again, who's going to take issue with most of these words up here? But how do we incarnate that? How do we see that coming alive in our relationships, in relationship to our spirituality? It's where I think the Christ-centered aspect of this becomes key. And how can the church be effective in promoting that through all kinds of ways in its program and in its various programs and in the way in which we become more conscious of the ways in which the church at times can go against some of this stuff, you know, can help to tear couples or families apart by when they do their programming or what about the possibility of the congregation saying, hey, let's have a thing where we'll take care of the kids for a weekend and you couples can go off and rejuvenate your relationship. I think there's a lot of creative ways that the church could do some important things that it's not now doing because we haven't tried to get in. Now, what are those qualities and how can the church as community much more effectively support and nurture those? I would hope that whatever we end up saying in an eventual social statement, it's not so much a matter of pinning down a position, but it's a matter of providing some parameters, some guidance within which there's freedom, within which there will continue to be differences. Because as you pointed out, we're all quite different in how we put this together in our own lives, relates to all kinds of the givens in our life and in our relationship and in the community that we live in, and it's very hard to have a homogenous, this is it, which again is why I get very nervous when we say the Christian family. Well, there may be some qualities that we try to nurture, but those families are likely to look quite different, and yet with some common values that somehow undergird what we're about. Well, thank you for your attention and for your input. This has been a lot of good discussion tonight. Thank you for coming.